Hey everybody, Ron Brinkman here with the VFX show number 9. And I'm here with John LaBrie, the former CTO of Weta Digital and an independent visual effects facility infrastructure consultant.
Well, I can't believe you remembered all that. Yeah, that's true.
I just made that up as a title.
That's great.
For you.
Hi, guys.
And also Mike Seymour of FXGuide.com and the FXPhD.com program as well.
Hi, how are you?
Mike, you there?
Yeah, man.
Hey, Mike. Good to have you. And our other usual suspect, Alex Lindsay, is actually off again in the wilds of South Africa somewhere. Zimbabwe, I guess, is where he's hanging a shingle for this week, and I think next week as well. So we'll do without him this week. And this week we are going to take a look at the movie World Trade Center, a nice, really good movie. First of all, something I quite enjoyed. I don't know what you guys what'd you think of the movie in general before we get into the effects. John?
Yeah, I enjoyed it actually. I kind of came away thinking it was a little bit underwhelming for an Oliver Stone film. I guess, you know, possibly things like Natural Born Killers or JFK have raised my expectations of the kind of, you know, frenetic editing and shot choices that he's going to put together. And this was actually a pretty restrained bit of work from that perspective, and maybe slightly boring. I remember my impression coming out generally about of the effects was, you know, that there wasn't a lot of work to really comment on there, but having a look later on at the things that were put together on it, that turns out to be a bit of a misplaced.
Yeah, and I think you know, I think they would, the effects people would love to hear you say that, because you know, it really was exactly what you want to do in a movie like this, which was not have any sense that there's visual effects going on, and really just be in the midst of the story. I know that Mike, you talked to some of the guys over at Double Negative who did the bulk of the work there, and that seemed to be their driving force behind all this as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that as is the case with a film that's this politically or I guess socially sensitive, they didn't want you walking out saying, hey, great visual effects, because it isn't Pirates of the Caribbean. You're not meant to be wowed by the ability for people to digitally recreate death and mayhem. It's a very sensitive subject, and I think that was reflected in the fact that even though many of the streets hadn't changed around, I mean, obviously the main Ground Zero had changed, but most of the relative areas hadn't changed, the filmmaker still had to shoot a lot of it in Los Angeles because it would be too upsetting for the local inhabitants to have the recreation of falling paper and debris and stuff just in, even in a film shoot kind of context.
Yeah, I mean, they built what must have been a pretty huge set of Ground Zero after the building collapsed, and then I guess they also recreated some New York streets to get some of the scenes where the papers were flying out of the building and filling the air and that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, the actual main set was built up on containers, like, you know, the cargo container things, big things that could withstand the weight of building the set up, so they could actually get underneath it to film up. And it was a huge area to film. And then New York itself, you're absolutely right, there was a lot of sort of building replacement, in the sense that, you know, you'd be shooting a crowd and from the sort of midway up the shot would all be blue screen, and New York City would be put in behind, as would a bunch of the debris, falling paper, and that sort of characteristic smoke that we've come to know so well from the footage of the time. And I guess that's the other thing, isn't it, that and John, you'd probably best to answer this. It's one thing to do a recreation of Middle Earth where, you know, you're interested to see what it would look like, versus actually reproducing something that probably is now completely iconic worldwide as one of the best known set of images of our time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that they did a really good job of it. I mean, it did feel to me very much like a lot of the images that we know from those days, even to the sense of a kind of, you know, graininess to everything, a very sort of realistic feel. And again, it never took me out of the work of the film, so kudos to them for that.
Yeah, it was, and I think, you know, your comment about the movie was fairly restrained. You know, I think they probably had to do some of that with the effects, just because the the event itself was so just huge and crazy, and but everything just felt really in there. And you know, there's so much of this stuff is, I mean, everybody had to be looking at the two towers whenever you did a lot of the establishing shots. For instance, there was no mistaking where the effects were, and everybody had to be just staring. I mean, I know I was, I was looking at it from an effects person's perspective, and you know, just expecting, okay, somewhere along the line the tracking is going to not quite catch or something like that. But it was very spot on. You know, even one of the original establishing shots where there was just a wide shot, and you know, you were circling around New York City, and you could see the Twin Towers in the distance, and you know, there was nothing that was moving wrong in that, as much as I was looking straight at it. And it sort of makes you wonder, you know, how much of that skyline was completely replaced versus just replacing the buildings themselves, or putting the towers back in themselves. And I don't really know, although I know a lot of, from what I've heard and read, it seems like there was some very substantial reconstruction of, you know, large portions of the city, even when it maybe wouldn't have been necessary had they been able to go there and shoot some of it.
Dive into that, was there anything that sort of stood out as a you know, a brilliant piece of work, or anything that kind of ended up bothering you as something that didn't work? Either of you?
I thought that the smoke work, for some reason, I'm really sensitive to CG smoke. And even in this one, there was maybe a couple of places where I was, again, you know, it's not there, and there might have been a couple of places where it was like, it still looks a little CG smoky, but probably probably less so than any other movie I've seen.
Now, Ron, I mean,
it felt very real.
Ron, the question we all want to know is, was the black levels good?
Yes, I had no complaints about the black levels. I mean, don't you guys see the same thing with smoke, though, a lot of times? It's really hard to define why it doesn't quite look right, but you know, there's so much CG smoke done, and I think it's something that's not been completely nailed yet.
It's one of the hard things, it's interesting. Right? Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah.
It's interesting, the renderer they use for that, the DNB renderer, the voxel renderer, because I think there's what's apparent to me, I guess, is that this film is starting to show the sort of new divide between what you really can do with just desktop apps with a bunch of guys sitting around and what you need a major facility for, because this has all the characteristics of, and obviously we've moved away from just a straight ILM, you know, gazillion shot epic like a Star Wars or a Pirates, but when you get a film like this, they had a short amount of time to do it in. They're producing photorealistic stuff, but they're having to use a lot of proprietary pipeline stuff, and stuff that, quite frankly, is, you know, the pipeline is the IP, because getting that New York building stuff done, for example, was a mammoth job, and something only really able to be undertook by somebody that had a pipeline in place that could do it.
Yeah, it's, you know, Double Negative was, I remember visiting them, I don't know, 5 years ago, and they were a fairly small house, and they've actually grown to be one of the larger facilities and doing just great work. But you know, their R&D team, their developers who are writing this custom code is sizable now. I think it's like 30 people or so. And I think you're absolutely right that it's a facility sort of has to have proprietary code. They have to be doing development work to extend beyond what the off-the-shelf software can do. Otherwise, they don't really have a value added, and they can't take on these shows with the confidence that you can if you've got a team that you know can go in and write code to fill in the holes, fill in the gaps.
Yeah, if you can indulge me, I reckon it's worth just stepping through the pipeline for those that haven't picked up on what they're doing, because I think we're probably apparent. It's apparent to us what's going on, but if it's okay with you, Ron, let's just step through that, because I think it's pretty interesting. The fact of the matter is that you guys were discussing HDR last week on the SidGraph show, which I think was a great show. And this film and the pipeline that the guys at Double Negative set up, both for Batman Begins and for World Trade Center, is a super example of HDR used at extreme level.
Yeah, and just the general kind of workflow of, I mean, to kind of really quickly summarize what they did for a lot of the building stuff is, you know, things were not just completely recreated out of thin air. They went to New York and they shot just thousands and thousands of reference photos. More than just reference, though, photos that were sort of specifically targeted at getting the proper textures of all the buildings that they'd have to build, or at least that they thought they would have to build, and getting very high dynamic range versions of those different textures. So you set up and you shoot multiple exposures of the building so that you get all the detail going down into the shadows, as well as into the highlights, and giving you the ability to then recreate or sort of put those textures into any lighting scenario and know that you have enough data range to cover all of that. And you do that for everything that you think you might need to do, and then that comes back and becomes the textures that are projected effectively or mapped onto the geometry. And it gives you very realistic textures, of course, and it also at times can help you not have to do as much modeling, although you still have to do a significant amount of modeling to make sure that things like perspective effects as the camera move happens correctly.
Yeah, there was 500,000 photos taken of New York, and they were everything from a 100mm lens to a wider 24mm lens, and that was bracketed exposures, which is what they did on Batman Returns as well. But when they brought those back, they get turned into HDRs, but then cleverly stitched together in their auto-stigs stuff, and that auto-stig stitcher sort of stitches these images together but doesn't actually stitch them. It just builds a database, like effectively a massive map of how all the HDR images go together, which means that when they come to do a building or whatever, not only can they get it from the HDR or whatever to use as a texture, but they can use photogrammetry to rebuild those buildings based off the triangulation of the images, and it's always accessing into this massively stitched together database to give you the kind of quality. Because they were, I don't know if you guys saw this, but they were rendering out the all their stuff at 4K.
Yeah, I read that. Sometimes even greater, apparently, just to deal with some of the moiré issues, the sort of rendering artifacts you can get, particularly if you have sort of evenly spaced lines, like for instance the vertical lines on the Twin Towers. I know they had to render some of that stuff even at higher resolution so that they could sort of super sample it and then downsize it to what they really needed.
And this is a pipeline that they put together for Batman Begins, right?
Yeah, exactly. Though by the time that was exactly 1 year ago they did Batman Begins, but by the time they came to doing World Trade Center, they'd increased the productivity of that pipeline about threefold. So that was like 4 weeks to turn around a photoreal building at 4K, which if you think about it, it's not bad going.
No, especially for how real it looked there.
Did you guys catch what they were doing for the interiors of the building? Because I thought that was pretty interesting.
No.
I heard a little bit about effectively getting the same sort of thing, a full texture map for the interior of a building, then just sort of mapping it onto an interior surface. Are you talking about an interior rooms that you would see from the outside, though, or?
Yeah, just to pick up on John's point, on Batman Begins, they did this, we need the rooms of the buildings to be kind of real and not just a flat piece of effectively paper sitting under the digital glass. So instead of having like effectively a flat plane that just sits there and has no perspective, they were projecting generic kind of spaces into little cubes that were the rooms. But on this time, they actually went and modeled the right rooms. So if you're in New York and you were to look around at the building behind the shot through the window, you would actually be seeing the correct room for that correct building, which I think is astounding. And they'd do a plus or minus two stops fisheye of that real room and then project it inside a cube so that as the camera passed the building, you would actually see perspective changes inside the real rooms. And that's an attention to detail that's pretty astounding.
It really is kind of, having seen how all these technologies continue to grow, and it's always this trade-off between what's the efficient way to do something or what can you get away with. And I don't know, I guess when I first started out in there, I sort of had the impression that somebody had come up with some sets of rules for how much detail you needed to put in and where you wouldn't see it beyond that. And I guess I've sort of come to the realization that there's just no substitute for trying to get as close to reality as possible, I guess partially because you never know exactly where the camera's going to go. But just in general, the number, the data that can contribute to a single pixel or something is still a very complicated thing. And I guess part of what's really amazing is this, like you said, Mike, the the database behind all of this, and this is something you could probably comment on, John, is, you know, for a huge production like this with such a large amount of data, the custom tools and the work that gets done is not always about the actual pictures that end up on the screen. I think we think of R&D as, oh, they wrote a cool rendering tool or something like that, but really it's about just pure raw data management.
It's one of the first things, or the first things I think I was successful in bringing to Weta was an understanding of traditional IT and how you could leverage the ability to move and manage information around to actually achieve visual effects. But I have to say that, I mean, one of the things that impressed me about what I've seen so far with the double negative story with respect to WTC is just that, I think as you said earlier, Ron, you know, they've got a substantial research and development effort, and it's the ability to not only to, you know, to gather all that information, but to come up with clever ways to stitch it all together and to assemble it into a huge database that makes so much sense. I mean, you're always going to get directors who want to show audiences something they never saw before, and if you definitely need lots of clever guys scratching their heads and figuring out ways to achieve things that haven't been seen. And if you want to get the best work going forward, you're going to have to be a shop that people can look at and say, we've got an interesting challenge here, and I think these are the guys who are going to be able to figure it out, not the guys who know how to boot up the software that everybody else already has.
Yeah, I think, you know, having an R&D team sort of buys you two things. It buys you the ability to do stuff that hasn't been done before, and it also really, maybe even more importantly, buys you the ability to fix problems that would cause productions to go way off schedule. You know, optimization of certain processes can result in orders of magnitude of speed ups, and sometimes you have to do that. You'll sit down and you'll realize, okay, we've set up this CG element or this character or whatever to be as exactly what the director wants, and it's, you know, photoreal and it's perfect, and he's totally happy with it. And then we went to render it and we realized that it takes, you know, 3 days a frame, and suddenly you've got this huge decision to make. Do you throw all of your resources behind trying to render this, or do you put some development teams on how to then optimize that? And optimization is very often something that has to be done at the coding level. So it's, again, having an in-house team definitely gives you a flexibility that you sometimes just wouldn't have if you were working on off-the-shelf
sure.
software.
I think they did some tricky stuff with the smoke, right? I mean, Mike, you might know more about this. They developed libraries of smoke sims or practical smoke. I'm not really sure which it was, actually.
Well, I think if you remember, we talked about wave simulation a while back on, I think it was Superman or when we were talking, and the same thing came here with smoke, which is a simulation problem. And we spoke to the guys at FX when FX Guide was talking to them. We spoke about the issue of whether or not it's better to approach this as a simulation or as a library. And of course, the argument is, well, if you could simulate exactly what was going on, you'd get a very accurate smoke plume. The reality is, however, that for any of us who have ever been on set and tried to shoot smoke plumes, simulations go wrong almost as often as live action filming of miniature stuff does. So it really came down to, rather than try and accurately simulate all the conditions and to get the perfect smoke they wanted, that they were better off producing sets of particularly high quality passes that could then be put together to produce what they wanted, because you know, simulations are the computationally difficult part of this exercise. Certainly in Double Negative's case, it was more time consuming to do the simulations than it was the rendering. And so, yeah, they built up a library of volumetric voxel rendered stuff, and then that was pieced together by the compositors, and then additional stuff added as required. And it's really a tribute to the compositors that they pulled that off so well, because as I think you said, Ron, that smoke stuff can look fake at the drop of a hat, and we all knew, you know, how that looked. And quite frankly, I think Double Negative just done a superb job with this, because it just works for me.
Yeah, well, it's the ultimate test, because there's not a bit of imagery that's sort of more burned in and familiar to people in the world these days in terms of this type of imagery. And so, yeah, you had to get it right. I mean, it must have been rather daunting when they set out, knowing just how good it had to be and how sensitive it was to be able to handle it.
They had a couple of other shots.
What did you guys think of?
Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, what do you thought of the that helicopter shot at the end?
Yeah, I think that's probably what you were going to ask about, right, John? Is a couple of the other shots that
I was going to ask you about
were
a couple of the shots during the collapse, but go ahead and let's talk about the helicopter shot for a second.
Oh yeah, well, and yeah, the helicopter shot and the pullout. I can't remember. There's a scene where are those the shots that were sort of back to back. Is that right? Does anybody remember?
Yeah, at the end of the film, there's the pullout shot, which is actually sort of three shots of the, which was, from what I've been told, a well-planned, well-executed shot. And then there was the helicopter shot on the 12th, which was, in fact, well-executed, but a very late addition to the piece. And I think I'm right in saying they managed to turn the helicopter shot around in, it's either 6 or 8 weeks from, hey, we need this helicopter shot, to producing what I think is a spectacular shot. Of course, they were using
And
the.
that was significantly CG, right? I think,
Oh,
I
yeah.
mean, just looking at it had to be that, again, it's one of those things where conceivably, they could have shot with a helicopter around the area and then just comped in the smoke in the area with Ground Zero in there. But I think you could, even just by looking at how good it was, you could sort of tell that probably a lot of the buildings around it were also CG. There was no telltale kind of compositing artifacts for putting it all together.
Yeah, it was a superb effort. I mean, obviously, it was built on the work from the previous shot because a lot of that had allowed that second shot to happen so quickly. But I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to have been at the meeting where someone said, "You know what? We've got a month and a half to turn this one around."
And they'll ask for it even faster the next time.
The comment I was going to make is that we were saying that there's Double Negative had a tough challenge because they were going to be recreating images that we're so familiar with. I knew that we were going to get an opportunity to see a little bit of what was going on inside of the buildings, and I was a little disappointed that it all went so fast. Of course, that was the reality of it all, but I didn't feel like I got a really good chance to see some of the work that was going on inside of there because it was all happening so quickly. That I mean, there's the sounds, there's the breakup of the lobby, there's I'll call it the avalanche of material rushing through the lobby and the concourse, and then they're kind of crushed in this space. And so I didn't get a chance. I'd almost want to go back and have another look again at the bits of work that are happening there because they go by pretty quick.
Yeah, and I think you're right that it was probably a creative choice as much as anything. But I think, it's true. It's still something that we just want to get our heads around, and it's just sort of a baffling thing about how this could have even, the physics, from a purely objective point of view, the physics behind it, and then and obviously from an emotional perspective too. But just understanding and wanting to really kind of try and figure out what really happened then. I think that's what you're sort of craving, and I was too, is wanting to see more of it. But I can also, from the filmmaker's perspective, I can also totally understand that, like you said, it just happened so quickly that there wasn't the ability to dwell on it then.
I kind of like that. I like that idea that you leave the table and you want more, as opposed to feeling like they hung around too long, or especially that they did gratuitous shots that, got to the point that you're kind of over it. I mean, I think the filmmakers, the visual effects team, were filmmakers that contributed to the plot, and it was a plot-driven, story-driven film, and it was completely apt. And quite frankly, it's almost a good thing to not sort of see everything, because I think that would have taken away something from the story, because of course they didn't know what had happened.
One thing I did want to comment on that I think was mentioned in the podcast you did with the interview with Double Negative on the Effects Guide podcast, which everybody should go check out as well. It's really great to hear the people that actually worked on it, their perspective on it, as opposed to three guys just standing around who didn't work on it. But one thing that was really interesting was that they had full sort of LIDAR, that's a laser scan of Ground Zero, that the government had gone out and scanned the whole area and done laser scans of all of Ground Zero, I guess just within a few days after September 11th. And somehow they managed to get access to it, which that may be even a little surprising in and of itself, but I thought it was fascinating that they had that level of detail, and that the government went out there and did that survey immediately after.
Yeah, it's an interesting line then, isn't it? That the, I mean, I think if Oliver Stone hadn't done what he'd done, which was keep it fairly grounded, he would have been torn apart. And clearly, as the film progressed, from what we're hearing, the nervousness about having an Oliver Stone slash conspiracy movie turned into an appreciation of what this film really was, and then obviously people were willing to help when they realised that it wasn't some kind of sensationalist exploitation of the story, and then yes, they getting access to that LiDAR stuff was amazing. And you know, interestingly, I saw completely unrelated a photojournalist who tried to document 9/11 and had an enormous amount of trouble because it was a crime scene. And we forget that, I guess, but in the period right after 9/11, it was treated as a crime scene, and just, you know, there wasn't like access. There was tremendous amount of you know, justifiable security, police, you know, everything else. And so even a journalist getting in taking photos had an extraordinarily hard time. So in many respects, while we know the footage really well, getting access to that kind of scientific or forensic information would have been invaluable.
Yeah. So we've kind of talked about a lot of the big effects, and I wanted to take just a second to talk about some sort of small things that they did, including a couple shots that were probably the only shots in the movie that didn't really work for me. But you know, there was a lot of stuff that he did with sort of selective depth of field, particularly. You know, Nicolas Cage is, I don't think it gives away too much to say that he spends a good chunk of the movie sort of partially buried underground, and a lot of shots that are just very close up on his face. And I'm pretty sure that some of that, there was some selective depth of focus and just, you know, in and out of focus done to help accentuate things. And, you know, very, very subtle in most cases, and just an interesting little bit of how the filmmaker can use something like focus to kind of control where the audience is looking. And, you know, that's nothing new. Filmmakers have been doing that since the outset, but the CG tools give us the ability to do it to a much greater level, or to control it at a much greater level. I don't know, has anybody seen anybody talk about what exactly was done there with that?
No, I haven't.
I haven't either. Do you think he was vignetting on his face?
I kind of think so. I mean, and you know, I was sort of thinking it when I saw it, and then the thing that really kind of made me believe that I really was seeing it and it was being done as a post-process is there's a couple of shots where Nicolas Cage's wife, played by
Maria Bello,
somebody help me out here, yes, is waiting at the hospital, and she's talking to another woman who is, you know, also had a family member or somebody that was... it was at Ground Zero, and they did something where they tried to explicitly put you know, split it so that one of the characters was out of focus while the other one was talking and going back and forth, basically putting in a very shallow depth of field as a post process, as opposed to having caught it in the original photography. And that there's only two or three shots like that where you kind of go back and forth and the focus changes between foreground and background, between the two actresses. And but unfortunately, it seemed to be pretty obvious what they were doing. There was a little bit of roto work that was obviously done to isolate them, and it felt very unnatural if you were looking at it. The edges kind of swam a little bit, and the focus didn't quite work. And that, you know, again, it's probably something that you really had to be looking for to see it. But it was about the only thing in the movie that I could even point to that felt like it didn't quite work in terms from a purely technical standpoint. From the story standpoint, it totally made sense, but it just wasn't quite.
I didn't even pick it, actually. I didn't see it.
I'm just sure. I didn't pick it either, but I must say I'm reminded of a review. You were talking about Nicolas Cage being buried. I don't know if you guys ever get the podcast of Siskel and Ebert, but I think when they were reviewing it, somebody said that that Nicolas Cage was so good in this film, so spectacularly good, that they want to bury him under 300 tons of dirt in every single movie he's in, because I guess the thing for a filmmaker is, you know, you didn't have a million options on how to shoot Nicolas Cage when he was trapped. You know what I mean? It wasn't like you had anywhere near the flexibility that you normally have for dramatic staging. You know, you've got a very confined actor.
Yeah, you were just right. And I think maybe that's part of why, you know, why they had to do some additional things to control what, you know, how the story was told. Because, yeah, you were just in there. It was the same angle and same shot for a lot of it. And it's true, though. He really, you know, I'm one of those people that sort of borderline on Nicolas Cage sometime, but I thought he was great in it. I think, you know, he totally nailed the character.
I must say, I like Oliver Stone when he does try a few things that are a bit different. Like for me, Any Given Sunday was a great example. I had a tremendously great dramatic scene near the end where there was a lot of simultaneous stories that we were following, and he did sports style multiple screen splits, so you had like three or four bits of vision running on the screen at once, and he cut to the interior of the box where one of the characters was at a dramatic moment, but he started putting the timer on those shots, which of course is sort of irrelevant because the timer was for what was going on in the game. But once you added the timer to that shot, the sense of urgency that this person was running out of time to pull off what they had to do was brilliant, and it was a complete left field sort of idea. And I think we need more filmmakers that are willing to try a few things like that. And you know what? I'm happy that even if they fail sometimes, because it can really add a layer to see that kind of, you know, breaking out. I mean, he didn't do much of it here, but he has in the past, as you said before, done some really interesting filmmaking.
I agree. I often, you know, I mean, I'd say I find a lot of his movies more interesting than enjoyable at times. But it's not like I don't enjoy most of his movies, and I think you're right. You know, this movie, he made the correct decision by not doing a whole lot of experimental stuff. But obviously, he's capable of doing it where it's necessary.
I thought the production design was good as well. So that also helps the visual effects team. There are obviously a number of ways that visual effects can go, but you have to fit in with the film, and you have to fit in with the general sort of production design and the sense and the color palettes and stuff. And you know, I was expecting that would be maybe something that I would object to, but it was good, I thought.
Yeah, it wasn't quite the wacky color stuff that he did with Natural Born Killers, was it?
No, hardly.
So I guess we like it.
I think so.
I think we did.
It. That's good. Good work. It was good work.
Very good.
It's incredibly hard to judge a film like
that,
isn't it? You know, it's hard to judge a film that's that kind of important or that serious a subject matter from what is, you know, just the visual effects point of view. I guess I'm most guilty of confusing those two areas. But I do find it hard not to judge visual effects inside the context of the film. And in the now famous Lost podcast, when we were discussing My Girlfriend Superhero, whatever it was, you know, it's just like...
My super ex-girlfriend.
There you
yes.
go. You know, it does feel like when there's... when visual effects can add so much to the storytelling, and it really is such a, you know, invisible yet serious contributor to the overall storytelling, it does kind of make you feel better about doing this for a living.
Very true. I think that kind of sums it up, is that, you know, it is nice to remember that in spite of all the really, really bad movies that abuse their visual effects privileges, movies like this really show that it's an important, valid part of the filmmaking process. Okay, any other parting thoughts by anybody?
Nope, not from me.
No, we're back.
Very good.
Back next week, Ron.
Yeah, we should probably decide a movie to see, and then yes, hopefully we'll be back here in a week. I'm not sure if Alex is going to be back from Africa or not, but we at least the rest of us will get together and come up with something new. So for John and Mike and myself, thanks for everybody for tuning in, and keep it real.